Okay, great. Thanks a lot for the invitation. And it's a great pleasure to be here. I remember last time when I was in Canada, not the Toronto airport, that was 15 years ago. And so today I'm going to talk about some recent work that I just finished with my colleagues in China. And some careful people may have already noticed that I changed my topic. And the original one was this one. And someone here, I promise not to mention his name. Yes. I promised not to mention his name, but he says this topic nobody cares here, so I have to switch the topic. All right, let's get into the physics. So here is the current status of the particle physics. So we have the particle table, and we have the quark and leptons and Gauge bosons. We know those particles for a long, long while, and we know the properties of those particles. And up to 2012, at the LHC, people finally find the Higgs boson. And also last year, LIGO detect the propagating gravitational wave. So now the most one of the most important questions from the particle physicist point of view is whether we need to add in more particles into the particle table. And especially, there are some motivations to add in more particles, which are mainly motivated by the dark matter. And there could be a whole sector associated to the dark matter. There are many independent and very strong evidence to support the existence of dark matter. For example, the rotation curve that people do the observation, where basically you can see that there is a huge amount of contribution to the energy momentum tensor actually missing if you do not include the dark matter and predict very wrong rotation curve. And the Bully cluster is also a very interesting evidence. When you have the two clusters merging with each other, the sum of particles, they tend to interact with each other, and the luminous region are actually not very well separated. And meanwhile, if you use the gravitational lensing, then the bottom of the gravitational potential are actually quite separated from the region where you have the most stable particles being concentrated. And the third piece, not the last, is the coming from the CMB simulation. And if you do not include the correct amount of the cold dark matter into the simulation, then you predict very wrong for the power spectrum. So all of those indicate the existence of dark matter. And how much do we have in our universe? So we know our star model very well for many, many years, but it only takes about 5% of the energy density in the current universe. And for the dark matter, it's actually 5 times more compared to the star model component. And we only know the existence of dark matter through its gravitational interaction. So what the mass of the dark matter and what is the interaction associated to the dark matter is totally remain unknown. So this is the very important question from the particle physics point of view, from the for the high energy and cosmology area. So there are multiple very popular choices for the dark matter. And the first popular choice is the so-called weakly interacting massive particle. Those are well motivated by the gauge hierarchy problem, and their mass are roughly showing up at the electroweak scale, which is about 100 GeV to TeV. And the second choice is the axion, especially the QCD axion. And this axion particle is well motivated by the solution, by the possible solution of the strong CP problem. So both two choices require you to put in additional particles into the particle table beyond the STEM model, and they are both motivated by the naturalness concerns. And the third possibility, which is the focus of the talk today, is the primordial black holes. So what is fantastic about the primordial black hole is, from the particle physicist point of view, is actually if the primordial black hole play all the role of the dark matter, then we do not need to add in any new particles into the particle table and explain almost everything in the universe. So this is something really, really cool. And because the property of the primordial black holes is dramatically different compared to the WIMP scenario or the axion, so the search strategy is going to be very, very different. And there are multiple ways that you can produce the primordial black holes. I'm only list two of those ways. One is using the multi-stage inflation, where you use the first step of the inflation to generate the small density perturbation as small as 10^-5, and then only up to the last few e folding of the inflation, you can have the very slopey profile, very slopey potential, and generate delta rho over rho being order one. And that is the way that you can produce primordial black holes by large density fluctuation in the small scale, which is still consistent with the CMB. And the second possibility is to consider a matter-dominated era before BBN. So this scenario is actually motivated by the moduli fields in a lot of supersymmetric theories. And because of the fact that before BBN, we have a long period of time where the matter starts to dominate the energy density, at that time, the structure can grow much more rapidly or efficiently compared to the radiation-dominated era. OK, so the primordial black hole will be the key motivation, focus of this talk. And it's kind of instructive to compare the detection strategies for different kind of dark matter candidates. So let me mention the most conventional way, the particle-like dark matter particles, the detection strategy for particle-like dark matter particles. And many of you have already seen this class for thousands of times. This is the indirect detection, the direct detection, and the collider search for the dark matter particles. And a lot of efforts has already been devoted into this area, but so far there is no concrete evidence to tell us that the any one of this is the correct way to look for dark matter. So recently, LIGO discovered the merger of the black holes, and it's kind of interesting to think about this in the picture of the previous slides in terms of indirect detection. This is a very rough an analogy, and what happens is actually you have the two. So this paper considered the scenario where the black hole merger, the black holes that being observed by the LIGO detector are actually primordial black holes instead of astrophysics black holes. So very likely this is an analog like two dark matter particles, like two primordial black holes. They interact with each other and generate the observable signals in the final states. So this is like a cosmological analog to the indirect detection of the particle-like dark matter search strategy. And for the very light dark matter particles, like the wave-like dark matter particles, so there are a lot of great contributions from the semi-local group, especially by Mina and Curly and Masha, that going along those lines to look for the very light dark matter particles. And here I only list some of the works that they do. So one of the you're here.
Okay.
Yeah. I know there is a work that is in progress that is associated with that. Yes. Okay. So one of the way that you can do the detection is the absorption of the very light dark matter particles. The strategy is very interesting. So you have the very light dark matter particles flying in the experimental background, and then once for a while, one of them will be absorbed by your experiment material, like the molecule, and then the molecule will be excited to the excited state, and the de-excitation of the excited state to the ground state will give you a photon signal, and you observe those photons outside the material. And it's kind of interesting to do an analog to what we are going to talk about in this talk, which is to measuring the gravitational wave radiation from the extreme mass ratio in spirals. So the extreme mass ratio in spirals are the system where are the process where you have the primordial black hole whose mass is much smaller compared to the supermassive black hole, and the orbiting of the primordial black hole will emit the gravitational wave radiation, and on the Earth, in the solar system, you observe those gravitational wave signals by the LISA-like gravitational wave detectors. And given the fact that solar system is in the universe, so this is a kind of an observer in the material. And this is a kind of a vague analog to what happens over there, that is for this dark matter observation. So a lot of efforts has already been devoted to the search of the primordial black holes. So we have the black hole evaporation and the energy density measurement of the time variation of the energy density variation of the dark matter, and coming from the gravitational wave lensing. And also, there are some constraints coming from the dynamics of the galaxy, dynamic measurement. And also, this red region is coming from the CMB measurement. That is the distortion that if there are primordial black holes during the CMB era, then there could be some distortion of the CMB power spectrum that putting a very strong constraints to the fraction of the dark matter taken by the primordial black hole. However, these strong constraints are currently under debate, and there are some arguments saying that this particular calculation has some mistake in it, and this constraint is actually dramatically reduced or weakened. So, I'm not sure about the mistake. There are some, I think that's how exactly the accretion of the matter nearby the primordial black hole during the CMB era that will somehow distort the spectrum. I'm not 100% sure. There are multiple papers about that, and that's in December last year, Mark Komikowski and his collaborators published a new paper to redo this constraint, and it becomes almost negligible now. Okay, so let's just get into more details about the gravitational wave detection. So there are multiple ways for the gravitational wave detection. So the first way is the fantastic way using a LIGO, and the LIGO has the frequency regime ranging from a few hertz to thousands hertz, and the best frequency peaks at around 100 hertz. And this is optimized for the merger of the black hole whose mass at other tensor mass. So if you want to consider the merger of the lighter primordial black holes, then because the mass will be become smaller and smaller, that will move the peaked frequency of your signal to the lower region, to the higher frequency regime. And that make the LIGO do not suitable for to look for the lighter primordial black hole signals. And also the magnitude of the gravitational wave radiation will become smaller. And the focus of the talk is to look at the LISA-like gravitational wave detector. We have the ELISA-LISA and some future proposed detector like DSIGO and BBO. So one of the most important scientific goals for LISA-like gravitational wave detector is to look for the so-called extreme mass ratio in spirals, where you have the astrophysics compact object that fall into the supermassive black hole, whose mass is about 10 to the 6 solar mass. And because the for the extreme mass ratio system, the gravitational wave radiation frequency is mainly controlled by the heavier object. So even you replace the astrophysics compact object like neutron star white dwarf or astrophysics black hole by lighter primordial black holes, they will generate the gravitational wave in the precisely the same preferred frequency regime as the LISA-like gravitational wave detectors. Okay, so that's why the LISA-like gravitational wave detector is possible to carry out this this search for the EMRI of the primordial black hole and supermassive black hole. And the good news there is actually the LISA experiment has already been approved by the European Space Agent, and the success of the pathfinder of the LISA actually make the noise estimation for the LISA to be very reasonable. Okay, now let me get into some details to calculate the event rate of the primordial black hole, supermassive black hole, EMRI process. So the event rate can be broken up into several pieces. The first piece is the so-called intrinsic EMRI rate, which describe how many describe the event rate for a primordial black hole fall into the supermassive black hole, where in the galaxy where the supermassive black hole whose mass is capital M, and the primordial black hole mass is lower mu, and this particular quantity has already been well studied in the supermassive black hole and astrophysics black hole system. And for us, the most crucial part for us is to redo this calculation and find the proper rescaling behavior respect to the primordial black hole mass and the density. And the second piece of this calculation is the mass spectrum of the supermassive black hole. This is coming from some astrophysics input, and usually people consider the mass range of the supermassive black hole from 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 7 solar mass. And this is just simply provided by our astrophysics friend, and we won't say anything new about the mass spectrum here. And the third piece is the supermassive black hole spin distribution. This one is, there are some generic expectations that the supermassive black hole in the galaxy center are almost extremal. And meanwhile, there are studies to show that the spin of the supermassive black hole do not cause any, do not cause a large difference on the final results. So for us, from the in our calculation, we'll take the spin of the supermassive black hole to be as large as 0.999. And the thing I want to emphasize is, even if you give a flat distribution of the spin distribution, it won't make a big difference. It's only changed by order one. And the last piece of the calculation is the co-moving volume integral. And this piece is very crucial also in our calculation, because this one will tell us how far we can do the integral of this rate calculation by setting the threshold of the signal noise ratio. And so in this master formula, the first piece and the last piece are the focus of this talk. And I'm going to show how those two pieces should be determined with the arbitrary choice of the primordial black hole mass. Okay, so let me firstly determine how many primordial black holes we have near the center of the galaxy. So the dark matter profile can be very well described by the collisionless cold dark matter simulation. And straightforward calculation will give you the NFW profile. And if you include more effect, other effects, for example, the baryonic feedback, then you will smooth the sharp profile of the NFW distribution to a more chord profile. And meanwhile, there are also some effects that seems to make the distribution of the dark matter even more spiky. So there are some calculations based on the adiabatic growth of the supermassive black hole that will give you an extremely spiky profile. And this is actually a whole series of study by those groups for the past few years. And there is a paper by those people, including Mark Komikowski and Silk, that they are taking the spiky structure of the dark matter distribution and use that to estimate the primordial black hole merger rate, the two primordial black hole merger rate. So what happens in the spiky profile is you have the NFW profile outside and up to 10 parsec distance away from the center of the galaxy, you have used the spiky profile start to take over, and it can enhance the number density of the the energy density of the dark matter in the center dramatically. So for us, we are going to take the middle point. We are not going to take the smooth profile, and we are not going to be nice to ourselves by taking the spiky profile. So what we do is we simply take the vanilla NFW profile, and that's it, to do our calculation. So the NFW profile has two free parameters. One is rho s, one is rs. Rho s tells you the normalization of the dark matter distribution, and rs tells you the distance where you switch from one power law to another power law. And so there are kinds of all complicated relations one can use to further simplify this NFW profile. The goal here is try to parameterize, to rewrite the NFW profile as a function, as a simple function of the primordial supermassive black hole mass, capital M. So first of all, let's do the change of variable, changing rho s rs to C200 and M200. Those are the more astrophysics motivated parameters. So this is just a simple change of variables. And then we're going to use some astrophysics input, which is the so-called concentration mass relation. And this relation is well studied in many papers, and particularly we take the formula from this reference. And this concentration mass relation is only valid in the low redshift regime. So we cannot use this, this relation to extrapolate too much back to the history of the universe. So for the validity of the astrophysics relation, we're going to truncate our calculation up to z equals to 1, the redshift equals to 1. So this is just an arbitrary truncation, and I'm going to comment on how to improve this. So if you use the concentration mass relation, you can write C200 as a function of M200. Now you reduce NFW profile as a simple function of M200. And then there is a very nice paper by this group in the astrophysics, tells you how to relate the M200 to the mass of the supermassive black hole. This study is by studying the bulge property in the nearby the galaxy center. And by using this relation, eventually we can write M200 as a function of supermassive black hole mass. So up to all those three steps, you eventually write this NFW profile as a simple function of supermassive black hole mass.
Sorry, I mean, yes. What the subindex 200 indicates?
Oh, so this is a very technical question. So when you do the calculation of the NFW profile, you can calculate what is the total mass of the dark matter halo. However, this quantity is actually diverged. So you have to truncate your calculation up to some point, and the truncation is by defining the average dark matter density in the halo is 200 times above the critical energy density in the universe. This is the 200 mils. This is a very technical and astrophysics motivated quantity.
What is G?
Where? For this? Oh, this is some function has the log inside. So it's just a you just do this and do the volume integral of the NFW profile, you will get some log. So this is just some function. If you want, I can give you the reference. Okay. So now we have the write the NFW profile as a simple function of the supermassive black hole mass, and then we can calculate how many primordial black holes are actually nearby the supermassive black hole. So one interesting fact that I want to emphasize is that for all of the EMRI process, they are mainly coming from the compact objects within the radius of influence of the supermassive black hole. And the radius of influence is the region defined by defined as the region where the kinematics are dominated by the mass of the supermassive black hole.
So like compact objects, you know, do you mean?
I mean, white dwarf, neutron star, and black hole.
So ordinary stars like the sun would not survive?
Oh, yes, that's right. So that's actually a very good point. So for the main sequence star and even the planet, those are actually fragile respect to the tidal force. So you can actually do the calculation of the tidal force. And for example, for the planet or main sequence star, they'll be ripped off before they reach the innermost stable orbit. So the innermost stable orbit that is about 6 or 10 times of the short stroke radius. So the tidal force at the last orbit is actually quite strong. So we actually did the calculation and we showed that the normal planet won't be able to survive. And this is actually a well-known fact for the for.
If you have like a solar type star, then it's like disrupted near the scope.
And so planets have even higher density than the sun does, and so therefore they would survive also.
Okay, then I don't know where this conclusion comes from, but actually we did the calculation for the tidal force. It's actually strong, so nearby the innermost stable orbits, the force is definitely much larger compared to the gravitational force.
I don't think that's right.
If the black hole is really big, then tidal force is negligible.
So crossover, I thought, was, was like supermassive black hole masses of like 10^6 and 10^7 in there.
So 10^7. So our calculation stuff range from 10^4 to 10^7. Maybe that's
okay, so
the yeah. We definitely stop at 10^7. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know whether that make it totally safe or
it's totally safe. I mean, right? Because like planets are denser than the sun.
So let me say the following: that later in the talk, I'm going to show you that for most of the events that pass the signal noise ratio are actually mainly coming from the lower mass supermassive black hole. I can tell you the reason for that. So even you have some subtleties in the heavy mass regime, then if you trust the calculation up to 10^5, 10^6 solar mass, then it should be fine. But I'm definitely happy to do some calculation for the tidal force offline to make sure this is right. Yeah. So we actually run through this argument with the astrophysics people. So this seems to be heavy with that. Okay. yeah. Then let's definitely talk about that offline. Okay. Good. But later I'll show you that our main result is the main contribution is coming from the low end of the mass spectrum.
If such things exist.
Yes. That's right. Yeah. Okay. So here is the radius of the influence, which is about 2 parsec away from the center of the mass the center of the galaxy. And this is actually something nearby the center of the galaxy. And then we can compare the number density of the primordial black hole versus the astrophysics black hole in terms of the NFW profile. And just to get some intuition, we take the benchmark number for mu equals to, we take the primordial black hole mass, 10 solar mass, and we take the supermassive black hole to be a million solar mass. Then the number density of the primordial black hole versus astrophysics black hole are actually comparable to each other. So it is actually reasonable to expect that there is a large, there could be impossible, possibly a large rate for the primordial black hole, supermassive black hole in MRI events. Okay, and now let me calculate the, tell you how to calculate the strength of the graphene wave radiation. So there are multiple ways to do the calculation of to estimate the signal strength of the graphene wave radiation. So the first way that I'm going to use is by this author and further more detailed study by Finn and Thorne. And they do the calculation based on the approximation where the orbit is circular and the orbit is mainly along in the equator plane. And of course, this is not a good approximation because we know that for most of the EMRI events are actually coming from the highly elliptical orbit and they are not mainly focused on the equator. So this is what people can do for the analytic calculation. And I'm going to show you that this is not a good approximation to estimate the magnitude of the graphene wave radiation, but it's actually give us some very rough estimation on the order of magnitude, because there is an improved some additional way to do the calculation, which is the so-called analytic cloud model, well studied by those authors, and depending on the approximation that you put into your calculation, it has the AKK and AKS, two different approximation limits. K and S stands for curl and Schwarzschild, and
so what is it? That the
emrys
are not circularized? Is there some simple reason?
So I think that's the most straightforward answer is coming from the numerical simulation. But I think the rough picture is you actually have the supermassive black hole and you have the compact objects running around the supermassive black hole. And then what happens is the 2-to-2 gravitational mediated scattering between the for the two orbits. For the two objects will scatter the one object to a more elliptical orbit instead of a circular one.
The pairwise scattering is significantly
high. So the crucial part here is actually to compare the time scale for the pairwise scattering time scale versus the time scale for a slow in spiral process. And the one that fall into the supermassive black hole is actually the one that will directly fall into the supermassive black hole without being disturbed. I'll show that in the very last few slides. This is the very typical calculation. If you are the expert, you may heard about the Fokker-Planck equation. That's the way to understand the so-called Fokker-Planck equation.
Yeah, but as you get closer and closer, scattering becomes less and less important compared to
gravitational waves. It's actually the critical value is mainly determined by the semi-major axis. It's not determined by the radius of the orbits. So you can actually have the orbits which are very elliptical, but the one that whether you can tell whether this one will fall or not into the supermassive black hole by looking at the shortest distance. So I think I'm just saying that there is probably larger probability to have more elliptical orbits than the circular ones. That's the I do not know. I'm quoting the result from the simulation. Yeah. Okay, so we have three ways at least to estimate the magnitude of the Granfenberg wave radiation, and this is the some results by the LISA group or at least by some of the collaborators in the LISA experiment, and they compare the three calculations. So the red one is the AKK, which is a more optimistic calculation of the Granfenberg wave radiation. Blue one is the AKS calculation, which is the more conservative one. And the one that is based on the circular orbit is the green one, which is almost always fall into the middle of the AKK and the AKS. So people usually use AKK and AKS to estimate the uncertainty of this calculation. But it seems to me, especially in the low supermassive black hole mass regime, those three calculations agree pretty well with each other. So in the following calculation, we are going to stick with the circular orbit approximation, and because this is a very simple way to do the calculation.
So just naively, I expect that if you consider very elliptic orbits as opposed to circular, they would have a lot less gravitational wave signal than the circular ones. So you're saying the AKK and the AKS are both elliptic?
Yeah. So AKK and AKS are actually not based on the circular approximation.
And what kind of eccentricities are you putting in for those?
Sorry, say it again?
And what kind of eccentricities are you putting in for these systems?
That I do not know. Those are way beyond my knowledge. And this is are the details studied by the LISA group. So what they show is the results coming from the AKK and AKS to characterize the uncertainty, and the circular approximation seems to be fine and fall into the middle of the estimation.
Okay, but I mean, you don't know what eccentricities they were using for those orbits.
I do not know.
Okay, but you did say for the ones that are forming by.
So I think for this particles. I think for this calculation, they are just coming from the numerical simulation. So it's actually a collection of all the ubiquity of the.
Yeah, and you have to put in some orbital parameters, right? And you're saying some of those are circular and some of them are not.
That I do not know. I do not know how the AK, the analytic cloud model are actually working. The only thing that I know is the circular one has the easiest analytic formula, and it seems to be reasonable to use. Okay.
What's the y-axis,
Oh, the y-axis is the so this is just one of the few plots that show up in that paper. So this is the redshift up to what redshift that you can actually observe the signal noise threshold. Okay. So here is the plot to show you the characteristic string of the for the Granfenberg wave radiation as a function of the frequency. And all those colorful bands are corresponding to different estimation of the experimental noise. So we took two noise estimation from LISA. One is C1, which is more optimistic, and also a C4, which is more pessimistic. And I was told by the LISA group that because of the very good success of the pathfinder of the LISA experiment, the C4 is over pessimistic. So, but just we just use it as a line to get the intuition and see how the numbers will change respect to the noise, And for different colorful lines here are corresponding to different choice of the primordial black hole mass. They range from 10^-1.1 and 10^-2. So as you can see, that the frequency, the shutoff, the maximum frequency that you can achieve in this EMRI process is actually the same no matter what the mass choice of the primordial black hole. This is just coming from the equivalent principle. And I will tell you the meaning of those few dots later. So this is at least saying that even you take the eternal mass 2 solar mass as the primordial black hole mass, is still in some frequency regime that can surpass the noise level of the gravitational wave detectors. And it's actually quite instructive to do a back of envelope estimation. So even LISA and LIGO are actually focused on the different frequency regime. However, the characteristic string they can achieve at the best frequency, at the best region they can achieve, is comparable to each other. So the characteristic string from the previous slides that for the circular approximation goes like the square root of the product of the primordial black hole mass and the supermassive black hole mass. And to achieve a comparable characteristic string, we can compare the primordial black hole mass. So for LIGO, the mu, both mu and m are taken to be 10 solar mass. So the thing under the square root is about 100 solar mass squared. And for LISA, if we focus on the supermassive black hole whose mass is 10 to the 6th solar mass, then in order to achieve the same level of the characteristic string, the primordial black hole mass can be as low as 10 to the minus 4 solar mass. So this at least gave us some kind of a confidence that using this LISA-like gravitational wave detector can achieve, can actually probe the lighter primordial black holes. However, this is not the end of the story, because there are a lot of subtleties in the calculation of the signal noise ratio. So here is the details. So the signal noise ratio is determined, it can be calculated by the ratio of the characteristic string squared, but also integrate on the open window of the frequency that during the that you can observe during the operation of the experiment. So this is some quantity that is extremely important when doing the calculation of the signal noise ratio. And the fact that you need to keep in mind is actually the in-spirals will last much longer compared to the operation time of the LISA-like gravitational wave detectors. So those are, the in-spirals can last like giga year, but the operation time can only last for a few years. So there is only a small fraction of the event that can be actually recorded by the detector during the operation. So those are the meaning of those few points. So this is 1 day, 1 month, 1 year, and 5 years. And because we are focused on the EMRI event, so it's, by definition, we look for the events where the maximum frequency has already been recorded. And then we just push back and look in the data to look for the signal in the 1 year or 5 year data sample. In the data. And the important thing here is actually if you lower the mass of the primordial black holes, you'll find the integration window, the open window for the frequency actually becomes smaller and smaller. This is quite understandable because when you lower the mass of the primordial black hole, the radiation power of the gravitational wave becomes smaller and smaller. So it will linger around the supermassive black hole for a longer time. So that's basically telling us even we can achieve the quite sizable characteristic string, we also need to be careful about the open window of the frequency. Okay. So here are some very simple rescalings of the open window of the frequency. This actually scale as the mass of the primordial black hole over the mass square of the supermassive black hole. And we also know the characteristic string scale with square root of mu times m. So if you combine both, you will find that actually lighter supermassive black holes are more helpful to increase the signal noise ratio. That's why previously I said that the, for most of our events are actually coming from the primordial black holes fall into the lighter supermassive black hole. Okay. So now after we figure out how to calculate precisely for the signal noise ratio, we can impose a threshold for the signal noise ratio, which is 15, a common number that usually LISA take. And that we can use that to calculate the truncation of the redshift in the comovial volume integral. So in summary, the truncation of the maximum redshift that we can consider is the one that gave me at least signal noise ratio passing to be as small as 15 or truncated by 1, which is the truncation imposed by the astrophysics relation that we use. Okay, so this is how we determine the comovial volume in our calculation of the signal rate. Okay, so now let me get into the a little bit more subtle part of this calculation, which is the one to calculate the intrinsic ERMRI rate. So there are two processes that we need to worry about for the ERMRI process. So the first process that can change the orbit of the primordial black hole is for the 2-to-2 scattering that is mediated by the gravitational wave by the gravitational force. So by when you have a primordial black hole pass any object whose mass is lower m, then this is the amount of the velocity that is going to be changed during this process. And because the primordial black hole actually go through a whole distribution of the objects, then you can calculate the time scale where you change the velocity or change the orbits by order one. This is characterized by the relaxation time, and this is controlled by the species whose m squared times n is the largest. So for the astrophysics expectation, the species control the relaxation time is the Mn second star. Okay? Because the relaxation time is controlled by the Mn second star, so there is no dependence on the primordial black hole mass for the relaxation time. Okay? So this is because this is sort of, you can roughly understand this from the equivalent principle point of view, because when you have the scattering, how much you modify your orbits really doesn't care how massive you are for the primordial black hole. Okay, so this is the first time scale. The second time scale we need to worry about is the time scale for the slowing spiral gradually loses energy through the gravitational wave radiation and eventually fall into the supermassive black hole. Okay, so this time scale can be calculated in a very straightforward way by calculating the gravitational wave radiation, and the radiation power goes linearly with the primordial black hole mass. That's why this time scale has an inverse linear dependence of the primordial black hole mass. And there is actually a competition between the relaxation time and the infall time of the primordial black hole. So the picture is quite simple, because where you have the supermassive black hole and you have a bunch of compact objects running around the supermassive black hole. And once for a while, they will scatter with each other and change the orbits. And if you change the orbits, if you change to the orbits where the gravity mediated scattering is not going to be important anymore, then the orbit will start to gradually fall. The object will gradually fall into the supermassive black hole, and by definition, that is the ERMRI event. Okay, so we can actually do our calculation by comparing the relaxation time scale with the gravitational wave radiation, the infalling time scale, and determine the critical value of the semi-major axis. And this one is just by comparing those two. And for the orbits whose semi-major axis is larger compared to the critical value, the ray scatter will dominate. And this will be corresponding to a redistribution in the phase space nearby the supermassive black hole. And for the orbits whose A is smaller than the critical value of A, then it will fall in and then generate the gravitational wave through the ERMRI process. Okay, so after we determine after we understand what's going on in that calculation for the critical value of the semi-major axis, then we can actually go to a little bit detailed calculation to estimate the intrinsic ERMRI rate. So the intrinsic ERMRI rate is determined by this so-called Fokker-Planck equation, and this equation tells us the relation between the number density distribution with the stellar current into the supermassive black hole. And there are very good semi-analytical calculations that can solve this Fokker-Planck equation. And this subject has already been pretty well studied in the content of the astrophysics black hole merging with the supermassive black hole. And people find that the semi-analytical calculation matches pretty well with the numerical simulation. So what we are going to do is to follow the semi-analytical calculation in this in the Fokker-Planck equation estimation to see how that intrinsic EMRI rate will scale with respect to the primordial black hole mass. And for the astrophysics, they do the numerical simulation, and it tells us how the astrophysics black hole EMRI rate scale as a function of the supermassive black hole mass. And this estimation is based on the astrophysics black hole whose mass is tensor mass. Okay, so for us, we need to find the intrinsic EMRI rate properly scaling with the primordial black hole mass and density. Okay, so I won't bore you with the detailed calculation for how to carry out the semi-analytical calculation for the primordial black hole, supermassive black hole intrinsic rate. After you do some straightforward but a little bit tedious calculation, you'll find that the primordial black hole intrinsic rate can be related to the astrophysics EMRI rate by the following scaling behavior. And it has a quantity called lower p. The lower p describes how the dark matter profile scales nearby the center of the black hole. And usually, after you include the mass aggregation effect, which is a quite cool effect, then people take p equals to zero. And the important scaling part for the intrinsic EMRI rate has the rescaling respect to the density and the rescaling respect to the intrinsic EMRI rate probability for a single primordial black hole. And you combine those two, then you can estimate the intrinsic EMRI rate for a primordial black hole with arbitrary mass. Okay, so now here is the final result. So this plot is just a small chunk of the plot that I showed you previously that include all kinds of primordial black hole constraints. And here is the micro lensing, the gravitational lensing, and those lines are corresponding to the SAMB constraints, which are actually under debate, and those are not actually, we should not take them very seriously right now. And those colorful lines are corresponding to the different choice of the gravitational wave detector. And as you can see that the, for example, for the LISA, the optimistic estimation for the noise, it can probe the primordial black hole mass ranging from 10 to the minus 2 to like other one solar mass. And the depth of the plot that you can probe can be as deep as 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 4. And by choosing different dark matter profile nearby the supermassive black hole, which is still uncertain right now, it can the shape of the curve can change a little bit. And this plot is based on the fraction of the energy density that is taken by the primordial black hole in the unit of the dark matter energy density. And in this calculation, I take the line as drawn to be the one that we only observe one EMRI event within the running of the operation time, which we take to be 5 years. You may say this is totally crazy because you just see one event. How can you make any statement about that? However, there is something very cool about the EMRI, because once you trigger the event, you can actually extract very precise information about the system. So for example, for the 10 solar mass, for the 10 solar mass astrophysics black hole falling into the supermassive black hole, the whole orbit will last for a very long time. You can get the full information from the whole runtime of the operation. So that can give you the precision measurement of the system as good as 10 to the minus 5. So even one measurement of the event is actually good enough to claim the discovery of the primordial black hole if it actually fall into the lower mass region. And the gray region here I labeled are the possible astrophysics background. So this gray region, the dark gray region, are the mass regime of the astrophysics black hole. And the light gray region is the region for the white dwarf and the neutron star, where the white dwarf star from 0.2 and the neutron star from one solar mass. So if the primordial black hole fall into the mass regime over here, maybe one event is not good enough to tell me to give me any concrete conclusion, and we have to probably wait for a little longer to see the mass spectrum, whether it will follow the white dwarf or neutron star distribution, or it will somehow peak at a different place. So this is the final result. Okay, now let me conclude. So in this talk, hopefully I convinced you that the LISA-like gravitational wave detector is quite powerful to look for the primordial black holes, and they can actually be very powerful in the low mass regime. And a large unexplored parameter space can be probed by the operation of LISA, especially for the mass regime ranging from 10 mass 7 to 10 solar mass. Of course, 10 mass 7 is based on some very future, far future detectors. And for LISA, it can be as small as 10 mass 3. So the fraction of the dark matter, of the energy density in the unit of dark matter for the primordial black hole can be as small as 10 mass 3 to 10 mass 4. Okay? And one thing I want to emphasize again is one or few signal events are good enough to declare the discovery, because in the astrophysics, you do not produce the astrophysics black hole as small below 5 solar mass. So if you find some compact object which have the mass as small as 10 to the minus 2, then it's almost for sure a primordial black hole. And a non-compact object like the planet will be destroyed by the tidal force before the innermost stable orbit. But it seems that this one is a little bit under debate, but let's check some number offline. But at least for the events that are produced by the lighter supermassive black hole, those are seems to be fine. So one thing, very interesting point about the EMRI for the primordial black hole supermassive black hole system is actually you can use the astrophysical measurement to so because LISA is actually one of the key goals of LISA is to measure the astrophysics black hole supermassive black hole merger events. So once you have the information about astrophysics black hole supermassive black hole events, then you can use that to calibrate the calculation of the primordial black hole supermassive black hole system. So in that case, there could be a chance that you can largely reduce the uncertainty from the astrophysics. For example, the mass distribution or the spin distribution of the supermassive black hole. So this can be, if this information is provided after some running of the of LISA, then it can help us to remove the hard cutoff that we impose in our calculation, which can dramatically actually enhance the signal rate. And this is precisely the reason why on the previous slide, the line over here is almost as a flat line, because the reason that the number of events do not increase when I enhance the noise level is because all the events are coming from all the events that being generated are actually coming from the events within z equals to 1. So this being flat is just because I have the hard cutoff at z equals to 1. So if I further relax that requirement, then I expect this line can carve into the deeper parameter regime. Okay, and I would like to emphasize that the lighter supermassive black hole can be more useful to look for the smaller primordial black holes. And this can actually give us provide us a kind of a guideline on the future LISA-like gravitational wave detectors, especially if you look at the noise level of BBO and DSIGO, they are actually more peaked in the high frequency region. Those are perfect to look for the light supermassive black hole merging system. So this is actually something quite interesting to keep in mind in the future. So I would like to end by the comment that LISA opened the era of the gravitational wave astronomy, and currently the time is very similar to the time when the CMB was firstly observed. So it is very, very exciting, and plenty of astrophysics can be studied by the direct observation of the gravitational wave, and as well as non-standard model physics. So combining the gravitational wave physics with non-standard model physics is something very interesting, and like Mina and Savas and other people like Masha, finally, are actually working on the super radiance, which is also a quite nice combination of the gravitational wave physics with the physics beyond that model. Thank you.
The very first plot you showed, or one of the first ones you showed, the mass, the constraints of the masses, and there was the change that had happened because, and since now you've told us what the mass was again, I forgot it's in that plot.
Sorry, you mean this plot, or the one?
I had the same information here, but I couldn't, I wasn't sure what was on there. So it'd be the very third slide or something. It wasn't
okay.
Yeah, I think
zooming
in
on
that one.
Yeah.
This
is
zooming.
This one?
Yeah, what is the?
Yeah, this is the zooming of this plot, which is roughly.
Gotcha, right.
This region.
Yeah.
Right, it's right there. So microlensing is the thing that excluded.
That's the data.
Yes, that's right.
I think I can go down to the 10 to the minus.
Yeah, but I just asked Neil during the lunch that the microlensing constraint will increase linearly with the time. So our constraint goes somewhere here, which is 2 or 3 order of magnitude lower than the microlensing results. So if you want the microlensing to reach some constraint over here, you need to wait 100 or 1,000 years.
Why is it cleaner than that?
Sorry, say it again?
Why is it cleaner than that?
Because.
Is it because it's the speed at which you discover objects? Or
so, presumably, like your amount of the rates should get better longer you observe?
No, but it's never. Is it linear? I don't know how it's supposed to scale. I'm usually
a fraction of the primordial black holes that pass through the sources.
It's proportional to the time.
So it's a fraction of the dark matter.
But presumably, yeah, but presumably the more sensitive you become, yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah,
but
it's just that.
Yeah, that makes sense. The other thing is, so in the region that you showed, you still need something else to explain dark matter.
Oh yes, that's right. Yes. Yeah, that's why I removed the dark matter from my title. Previously, the title is "Search for Primordial Black Hole as Dark Matter." Now it has nothing. Almost has nothing to do.
So the ones that you have there as question marks.
Sorry, which one is question mark?
The green.
Oh, this one? Yes.
Green. No.
The left.
Oh, this.
Yeah, because that one over there is not. Even if you look at your post papers, there's.
That's right. There. So this plot I just take from some blog, so it's not a serious plot. So there are multiple different ways to cover this region, and remember, Peter and Sujit also have some primordial black hole triggering the explosion of the white dwarf that can also cover that region. I just find that plot
so
to be.
So there's no region where the black holes are.
So the latest the December Kamienkowski paper says that the most conservative CMU start at 10 to the 2. And go up.
Oh, and they go up.
Yeah.
So,
right. so
it's basically just to remove this pink region.
Over to 10 to the 2. So that little hole between microlensing and binaries, maybe. Is
yeah, we're just looking at it in the morning.
You had,
didn't look like
it was there.
Yes.
So you could also evade the constraints if you had a distribution over the mass, right?
Yes, that's right. So there are some. There is actually one paper that Mina and I we were looking at in the morning that is talking about the extended mass spectrum as for the primordial black hole. Yeah, if you need, I can send you the reference.
But that's something that you wouldn't expect. There's like typically one time when they're produced and they're all the same mass.
Okay, good. So you're asking whether, so how solid my result is respect to the mass distribution, right? So let's say that, so indeed, so the current result is based on the almost a delta function for the primordial black hole mass distribution. But you can imagine that there are some broadening effect that's mirrored out as into some wide range. However, if in that case, you just look for the peak value of the mass distribution, and hopefully that won't be diluted by too much. Let's say by 1 order of magnitude, then I just need to rescale my my result by that. Yeah. Yes.
So I'm wondering in your signal-to-noise ratio via MIR, is that mainly coming from the spiral like far outside, or is coming from the spiral close to the innermost stable orbit?
So
you're doing integration of the signal to noise ratio with
yes.
a certain frequency range.
Yes.
I was wondering whether.
You mean where exactly? Yeah. That's a good question. I think that is mainly coming from the last few orbits of the rotation because the way that we do the calculation of the signal noise ratio, that is calculating the square ratio of the H. So let's say, for example, I observe this part. So it actually depends on where exactly this shutoff frequency stop at. If for this one, for example, the maximum frequency stop at the most precise region of the LISA, then for sure this part is the part give you the most contribution in my integral for the calculation. But if I have the line that is actually go this way, which is more which is actually generated by the smaller supermassive black hole, then I will benefit mostly for the later part of this signal.
Yeah, so I think I'm asking this because when you are talking about that tidal disruption, you are using the innermost stable orbit at the place you calculate this. But
mm-hmm.
because we know if you are going like 2 times larger radius, then the tidal force is also, I think, reduced a lot. So I'm just
mm-hmm.
wondering, because you are trying to say that astrophysical compact object would not mimic your signal, but I'm wondering whether that could be
Good. So let me try to understand your question. So your question is trying to say that if I have the astrophysics object that actually being disrupted one before it's falling into the supermassive black hole, can I distinguish that with the compact object? Is that your question?
Yeah, like in your calculation, do you consider those which has already been disrupted?
Yes. So I have to say, I have to admit that this calculation here is not it's not very careful. This is definitely not the way that LISA will really carry out their calculation for the signal noise ratio. What they should really do, or they will really do, is by imposing the filter function and use that to calculate the signal noise ratio. And the signal noise ratio that we calculate in this way is only provide us a very rough estimation for the signal noise ratio. So I would guess that if I have the object that being disrupted before it really fall into the supermassive black hole, the signal will be very different compared to the filter function that I impose that is motivated by the compact objects. So I would say that may be the one that I can use to distinguish the signal versus the background. And also for the white dwarf and neutron star, I do not know whether there is any possibility to distinguish it from a primordial black hole. For example, whether there is any kind of a tidal force induced vibrations or any kind of subtle details that may come into the calculation that change the waveform, I do not know. But there that's a very interesting and active area for people to study. Yeah. Okay, thank you.